Well, our guest this morning, we got a guest on this morning called Galen Boffman. He was convicted in the back, and he used that civil commitment to lock him up. And civil commitment is something that a lot of folks are not familiar with. We talked about it a few times about Galen and a couple other guys on the show. Galen, are you there?
Hey, Roach. It's so good to hear your voice good in morning. The free world.
Okay, I'm glad to have you with us, man. How you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. Thank you.
Okay, and you've been home how long?
So I've been home about 5 months now, and this is after going back into the system for 4 years, 3 months, and 2 weeks on a technical violation that did not carry any jail time under the Virginia sentencing guidelines.
Okay, you want to explain to our listeners exactly what a civil commitment is for those folk who are not aware of it?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a confusing term because civil commitment also is generally used to refer to a legitimate system that also has some critics of involuntary psychiatric commitment. So it's the concept that somebody has a serious mental disorder, and as a result is having difficulty caring for themselves or, could be a danger to themselves or others. And so they're held in a hospital setting for treatment, and then they're released promptly when treatment is completed. And what happened in the late 80s and early 90s at the tail end of the truth in sentencing laws in this country, where lawmakers were essentially abolishing parole, which I'm sure your listeners know all about, and instituting systems where they had to serve usually 85% at least of the sentence that the judge handed down. What happened was that people, lawmakers found that they wanted to keep holding people under a parole-like system but didn't have the legal opportunity. So what they did was they used the traditional medical model of civil commitment to smuggle in a back door around the constitutional protections against ex post facto law and double jeopardy. So just to make really clear to your listeners, this is a system designed to lock people up twice for the same crime. Or another way to look at it is they're punishing for you for what you might do in the future. This is what we call pre-crime preventative detention.
And that's they lock you up. They can lock you up on civil commitment for what they think you might do in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. In my personal case, I was out in the free world for 4 years. I did not commit any new criminal acts. And at the, based on a technical violation, which, many criminal justice reform advocates now feel very strongly should never lead to someone being in a locked environment in a carceral setting. They used that as a bogus basis to claim that I was too dangerous to be released. I'm explaining slightly backwards, but When I finished my prison sentence originally in 2009, I had been locked up when I was 19 for a consensual relationship with someone who was underage. He was in high school. I was in college. I was supposed to get out in November of 2009. And 3 weeks before my release date, I got papers from the state saying that they would not honor my release date, that the Virginia Attorney General's office had unilaterally petitioned the state to indefinitely detain me under the label that I was, quote, so likely to commit a future act of violence that I constitute a menace to the health and safety of others, right? So likely menace. And
wow.
I was then held for 28 months in jails and prisons, most of that time in solitary confinement at the Arlington County Jail. And this is a system where they're claiming that they're not punishing you, right? The pretension, the lie that they told the U.S. Supreme Court is that the intent here is not punishment, and therefore they call it civil, quote-unquote, as opposed to it being in criminal law. But I can tell you, Roach, solitary confinement for 28 months past my release date, that's absolutely punishment, and the lawmakers
torture.
Know that.
Yeah. That's torture. I know about solitary. That's torture. You just said something. You serve your time waiting to be released, and you get a letter from the Attorney General state that they're not going to honor your release. They're going to hold you indefinitely and hold you for 20-some months and place you in solitary without a charge, without a case, and your time was up. Is that what you just said?
Yes, sir. Yeah, so for all the listeners, the United States, people are absolutely held in 20 states in the federal government. People are being held in prison and in jails in explicitly punitive environments after they have already completed their prison sentence, which is why Just Future Project's campaign is release on release date. And I would tell you, we've had dozens of legislative meetings, and we have not spoken to a single elected official so far in Virginia who has actually been able to tell us that they disagree with the premise that when, at a very fundamental level, when a person has repaid their debt to society, when they have completed their prison sentence, they get to go home. And these systems are just designed to indefinitely warehouse them in cages after the completion of their sentence.
So, Galen, this is Nkechi. How are you?
I'm fantastic. It's so good to hear your voice, Nkechi.
Always good to hear your voice. So, I know recently there was a bill that was introduced in Virginia to abolish the state system of pretrial. Pre-crime. This pre-crime thing. What was that movie? There was some kind of movie dealing with pre-crime.
Oh, yeah. It's called Minority Report. It was Tom Cruise in 2002.
Right. So, to abolish that system, pre-crime preventative detention. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, and I hats off to Senator Joseph Morrissey, he's a Democrat from Richmond, for his moral fortitude in attempting to make Virginia a leader away from these dystopian Kafkaesque systems. The bill is a clean repeal. It would simply remove this statute from the code books in Virginia and take us back to what 30 states are already doing, which is using the criminal legal system to address harm. When they first created these laws, the excuse for them was that they needed a stopgap measure, quote-unquote, to capture people who had already been sentenced but had been sentenced incorrectly or not long enough or whatever. And they passed this law originally in 1999 in Virginia. They've had every opportunity and have taken it in Virginia again and again and again to do nothing but increase the penalties for criminal behavior in the Commonwealth. And so the premise that we, need a system because the sentences aren't, the sentences couldn't be any longer.
So this bill, is there precedent throughout the country on this, or is this the first time this is being, a bill such as this has been in effect?
A lot of people have been asking that question, and as far as we can tell, no one has ever proposed dismantling one of these systems in one of the state legislatures or at the federal level since the first law was introduced in 1990.
Wow. So what Nkechi just said and what you just said, it surprises me that nobody submitted a bill like this, sexually violent predators, this pre-crime prevention detention where they lock you up on what they think you might do in the future. It's like one of the caseworkers is as a crystal ball, and they say, we're not going to release you because you might do something in the future. And because of what we think you might do, you're not going home. That's a violation of all basic principles of law. You got a constitutional right, man, to be confronted with your accuser, and your time is up. You serve your time, and they still can hold you past your time that the judge sentenced you if they make a determination that you might commit another crime in the future.
Sitting in my cage, altogether it's been 51 months past my release date, I have spent in a carceral setting, and I've never actually been committed to the shadow prison in Virginia. That's what we call it. We don't. They pretend it's a behavioral rehabilitation center. It's all just terrible PR branding. It is. It looks like a prison. It talks like a prison. It has barbed wires and a punitive intent like a prison. So we call it a shadow prison. These people are essentially disappeared to this facility downstate. but sitting in my cage, there was something fundamentally broken about these laws in the social contract between me as an individual and the state. The state claiming that they could somehow know my mind And as a result, know what I would or would not do in the future is preposterous. And let me talk just briefly about the psychology here. The American Psychiatric Association. So these are the people with MDs who are the arbiters of what is and is not legitimate involuntary medical psychiatric commitment, have said for 22 years, after an exhaustive 5-year study, they concluded in 1998, that these laws are nothing more than a bastardization of the medical model of civil commitment, that they are another name for a cage, a legislative intent to contain people twice for the same crime without any valid psychological basis. And one of the core concepts they point to, which I think will startle many of your listeners, Roach and Ikichi, is that they're essentially medicalizing crime. So the state argues that because you committed a crime, you must have some psychological problem. And as a result of that psychological problem, they can predict that you must be likely to commit future crime. So there's this circular logic to this that the American Psychiatric Association so deeply objected to, and virtually none of the people in these facilities are diagnosed with legitimate psychological disorders. There are some, what they've done is try to create labels. For example, my favorite is they try to create a psychological disorder to mirror the crime of sexual assault, right? So it turns out that the psychiatrists have said all along that people don't commit sexual assault because they have some sort of psychological disorder that makes them commit sexual assault. Any more than, a straight man who's attracted to a woman, rapes a woman because he's attracted to a woman. They commit a crime because they didn't respect the other person. They made a moral choice. And our system is about holding people accountable for that moral choice and helping them reintegrate into the society at the end. The people who prostitute their professional credentials to the state to try to support these pre-crime preventative detention systems try to come up with this term, rapophilia.
Rapophilia.
It is not in the DSM. It is not recognized. Many of the people in, we laugh because it's absurd, right, that they're so transparently trying to create a diagnostic label, a pretextual diagnostic label, as a basis to indefinitely detain somebody in a quote-unquote treatment center after they complete their prison sentence, when it's just obvious that this is the crime of, a rape that they are trying to turn into a mental disorder. and 30 states don't do this. But let me talk briefly about the recidivism data, because this is sort of a sticking point for a lot of folks, and it speaks to the ability of these systems to predict whether somebody is or is not going to commit a future crime. The label in Virginia says a person is so likely to commit a future act of sexual violence. It's a statutory term, so likely, that they constitute a menace to the health and safety of others. So keywords, so likely, and menace. They have let out, as of last March 1st, 483 people who were designated as so likely to reoffend in Virginia that they constituted a menace. So as part of my own case, we asked Department of Behavioral Health and Developmental Services, which is like the mental health agency in Virginia, we asked them, so these people in your custody who you've now released as so likely to reoffend, how many of them actually reoffended? How many of these people labeled as so likely to commit a future act of sexual violence actually committed one of those acts?
The answer, how many was it?
It's two people out of 483. That is a recidivism rate of 0.4%.
2% recidivism rate.
0.4%. So it's two persons, two people, and it's a percentage of 0.4.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, and these are the people that had been labeled so likely that they, based on some sort of volitional impairment causing psychological problem. So there are two possibilities. The first possibility is that Virginia just sucks at determining who is or who is not likely to reoffend, which is probably true if you, you know, take a second to look at the bias system that they use. What the American Psychiatric Association has said all along is true, which is that this population that they claim to be targeting doesn't even exist. Wow. So the reality is that, you know, people who, you know, cause serious harm in our system, and many people who never cause serious harm, get incredibly long prison sentences now. And, you know, people like Nkechi and you are trying to change that. I'd like to be part of the solution, but the reality right now is that, you know, most of these guys are getting out, if they had serious criminal histories, they're getting out of prison, if at all, when they're very, very old and incredibly unlikely to reoffend.
And they age out of crime. Precisely. Let me ask you this, Galen. Who makes the determination? If you said you'd done 51 months past your release date and they held you in custody without a charge on this Sexual Violent Predator Act, who makes the determination? I guess what I'm asking is, now they got somebody in the correctional field who can foretell the future. They got a crystal ball. They can say, what Gail are going to do, you can break the law again. These people should be in every prison system around the world. If they can predict who's going to break the law again, and they holding you on what somebody else think you might do, and you've been locked up 51 months. Did you get any compensation, financial compensation, or anything for keeping you 51 months past your release date?
No, and the second time, the jury actually voted against me. So I had literally the same trial twice. The first one was in 2012. After waiting for 2.5 years almost. And then the second one was in late September, October of 2019. Let me try that again. It was the exact same accusation from the state, you know, the same fraudulent diagnoses. And which, you know, fascinating about the second time is that there's a process in Virginia where the commissioner of DBHDS, which is our mental health agency, is required by the statute to appoint a quote-unquote independent evaluator. I don't really think they're independent at all because they're financially beholden to the state and they work very closely with the prosecutors. But, you know, fine, independent. That person concluded that I did not qualify under the statute. So what did the Attorney General's office do but go out and hire their own hand-picked expert, asking them to not complete a mental health assessment or a mental health examination, as the term in the statute, but to just simply do a file review. And they based their petition on that person. And then they proceeded to hire her for more hours than she had spent for the entire other 23 cases she had done under the statute. So 24 cases she'd done altogether. This all came out through the subpoena data in my case. She did 23 of them legitimately under the DBHDS system. She did one case for the AG's office, and she spent 108 billable hours as of our subpoena result, which is about a month before the trial. Yeah. When the question is purely subjective and it's about quote-unquote risk, you know, the question of how high is too high for risk is purely subjective. So, you know, the actuarial tool that they use in Virginia is explicitly homophobic, for example. There's a question on it. There are only 10 questions. One of their questions is all about historical past, you know, facts about you, like your crime of conviction, things like that, your age. One of the questions is, did you have a male victim? Well, they only give this test to men, Roach. So this is a proxy for, are you gay? And if you're gay, they score you as high risk. So if you're young, gay, and did not commit incest, they think that you're automatically high risk, which is absurd. And let me just briefly say the projection that they offer for recidivism, even under this, you know, quote unquote high risk, you get a 5 on the static 99, static 99 R. That correlates to 86% not likely to reoffend. Right? So the, you know, they're targeted. There is no way to do this right, which is why. Yeah.
A lot of folks are not familiar with this violent sexual predator and how they can lock you up and hold you away. I can imagine when you said you did 51 months past your time and he put you in solitary. And I did a couple long stretches in solitary. And I know what that is. And I earned my way in solitary. Here you in prison and you're not supposed to be there. And he got you in solitary. Is there a high rate of suicide or guys killing themselves because of this kind of treatment of being locked up without a charge and being forced into a prison and you can't get out?
I can't speak to rate.
Has anybody got any figures or stats on the suicide of these men and women are being held against their will for a charge that somebody said they got a crystal ball that Galen was going to break the law again in the future, and him and Roche got to come back. We ain't gonna release him because I think they're going to do something wrong. That could have been used against a majority of people coming out of prison.
Especially when they're broke and ain't got
no money. They ain't got.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. That's the problem is that once the state starts, you know, basing future behavior based on historical events, you know, they claim that the past is the best predictor for the future, but it turns out it's an actually terrible predictor. The answer to your question is no. And these systems are incredibly opaque. They treat them as a black box. They hide between quote unquote patient confidentiality. They claim that these men who are shadow prisoners are quote unquote patients. And so, for example, in New Jersey, where they have one of these facilities in Avenel, they literally take the guys, you know, on their release date from the prison, walk them across the yard to the old solitary wing, which is now the quote-unquote treatment facility, place them in the treatment facility, and then record on the books that the person has been, quote, released. So if you call the prison and ask where they are, they'll say, oh, well, we don't know, he's been released. And if you call the mental health agency and ask where the person is, they'll say, oh, we can't, you know, confirm or deny. So they're literally disappearing people like the Soviets used to do.
Yeah, this is not a musical sales, and they're changing the sales, and they're disappearing. Nikichi,
a colleague of mine just texted me, Fahima Sek, and said that she turned down a position as a social worker in the state of New York early in her career, and where they were holding men after their sentence who had served time for sex convictions. She said she'll call in, so maybe after the break we can hear from her, because this is a personal example, I guess, of someone turning down a position precisely because of this unconstitutionality, I would say, in terms of holding people beyond their release dates.
You know, we're going to take a break. No, we won't take a break. We'll let people, if you wish to call in with a question for Galen or Nikichi or I, the phone number to call is 202-588-0893. That's 202-588-0893. Folks,
okay,
we talked about...
trying to call and... You know, the PFW needs to pick up the phone.
Okay. Go ahead. Folks, we talked about this a couple of times in the past, but here you can be locked up because of what they think you might do and keep you indefinitely. And this is happening all over the country. As Nikita said, this is a constitution. You're not supposed to be incarcerated without a criminal case, without a trial, or some facts or information. They lock you up now on what they think you might do. If I went to prison and my release date, they won't let me out because they figure I might rob a bank again tomorrow. But this is for violent sexual predators. And Galen said that he was in college. He had sex with somebody who was a high schooler. And because of that, he's been tagged as a violent sexual predator. And they held him 51 months past his release date because somebody suggested that he may rape or be involved with a violent sexual act again in the future. This is preposterous, people. That's like saying that any one of us who to come out of prison who don't have a job might commit another crime again. You certainly will if you don't have no money and no job and nothing to do. You know what I mean? Well, we got our call on the line right now. Come on, Khalil. We take our first caller, Khalil. You're on the air, please. Question or comment?
Yes. Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. This is Sister Fahima. I just wanted to share a brief story. About 20 years ago, I was offered a position early in my career as a social worker at a place called Kirby Forensic, where they were holding men after their sentence indefinitely. And I, of course, declined the position because I knew it was a class action lawsuit in my view. And I know in the state of New York 20 years ago, they were holding men who had, after they had served their time for sex offenses, they were holding them indefinitely. They told me, you don't have to do any discharge planning, just do groups. And I, because there was no light at the end of the tunnel, I didn't think it was a good idea to take that position.
Huh. And that was only in New York. Is other states doing the same thing?
Yes, the state of New York. This was Finley Forensic, which is a state facility, and they were holding, and these were prisons. These were jails, prisons rather, and they were holding these men after they had completed their sentences, and they were holding them indefinitely, and I wasn't something I wanted to be part of. It sounded like a class action suit about to happen. Anyway, that's all I wanted to share, and thank you for taking my
call. Let me ask you,
let's see if Galen wants to have any commentary on that before you hang up. Galen?
I thank her for, you know, her ethical decision. I think too many people are prostituting their professional credentials to the state, and it's just, this is a cottage industry. People are making lots and lots of money, and it's wonderful to hear somebody that had, you know, the moral courage to say that these systems are wrong and choose to do something else with their life.
Thank you.
Let me ask this question. Is this only for people who got sexual offenses? What about somebody, a bank robber or stick-up boy?
Well,
I haven't heard of them being held past the release date. So this is only being used, applied for people with violent sexual offenses?
As the gentleman said, it was a civil commitment program, and they had already served their time, but they were not going to release them, and they were holding them indefinitely. And it just, there was no light at the end of the tunnel. And I didn't see, you know, because as social workers, we're helping people to get on to the next level, the next step. And they just wanted me to do groups and no discharge planning.
Well, that's cool.
I think we have two more callers on the line.
Oh, Bruce, if I could respond briefly to what she just said. There was a large federal lawsuit out of Minnesota, and the judge said that the one single characteristic that could characterize these systems is the hopelessness of the men stuck in them.
Oh, wow. That's cold-blooded. Well, we'll take our next caller, please. Hello, we'll take our next caller.
Hey.
Hello, you're on the air, please. You're on the air.
Hey, Rose, this is Jabari Zakia.
Okay.
When I was on your show in 2019 talking about supervised release, this is exactly the purpose of why those laws were instituted in the middle of the Reagan years, in the middle of the 1980s. Uh-huh. The whole purpose, I think people need to understand what's really going on. This has absolutely nothing to do with the Constitution. This is purely political and economic. They are concocting a way to keep predominantly black and non-white people in prison without having to go through the exercise of actually having to convict them for a crime. 35% of the people in the federal system, at least 35%, are there for technical violations of supervised release.
Right.
And supervised release is unconstitutional. So, and the black politicians go along with it, the black caucus go along with it, the judges, the lawyers, ACLU goes along with it, the sentencing projects go along with it, because they don't attack it at its root as being fundamentally unconstitutional, and anything that comes after it is fruit from a poison tree. So yes. Then what needs to happen is the public has to understand that they politicize and demonize people on all these fronts. They demonize you on the sexual front. They demonize you as a menace to society and so forth. And most of us buy it. Most of us, when we are asked, should people be put in prison who have a potential to rape your little, you know, your son or daughter, they say, yeah, throw them in prison. They could care less about the Constitution until it happens to them or somebody they know. So I'm just saying that you shouldn't be surprised, but the way to combat this has to be a two-front approach. There needs to be a active and concerted issue by different law groups to attack it on a fundamental constitutional basis. But ultimately, this is going to be a political issue, and people who are going to have to go into these offices in Congress and the state legislature with the mindset that we're going to end this thing, and we're going to have to create a society so that people have the money, the housing, and the other essential needs, so they don't get stressed out and do these irrational things that are bound to happen when you put rats in a cage and then you take away all their resources. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for calling in, Jabari.
You want so just to, a couple of things Jabari said? Galen? Yeah, so, one of the things you pointed out right there at the end there is the concept of primary prevention, which is the idea of, instead of just punishing quote-unquote no-defenders, people who've already been held accountable for their offenses, the vast majority of sex-related crime is committed by over 95%, according to DOJ, of sex-related crime is committed by somebody who's not on any list. They don't have any prior conviction. And so the states that just focus on the 5% of crime that's committed by somebody who had a prior are by definition ignoring 95% of the problem, and the premier victim rights and survivor groups around the country and at the national level have said for years that the best way to prevent sexual violence and child abuse is primary prevention. We don't invest in that as a society, and Virginia had put $750,000 per year for 2 years on the books. When COVID happened and there was a $1 billion budget shortfall, they cut it from the budget. So it was not actually funded, and that was the primary prevention budget for Virginia. Meanwhile, they spent $110 million to expand the warehouse facility where they hold these men, the shadow prison. That's 258 beds, which comes out to $426,000 per bed to warehouse people in a cage after the completion of their prison sentence. And the best part is when they funded this, the $110 million, DBHDS admitted that they would run out of beds again in less than 2 years.
Is there anybody tagging this issue on as a class action nationally all across the country? Because this is happening all over the country, man. What can be done, or what's being done, to attack this? I know the legislation that was submitted recently by Joe Morris.
Yeah, Virginia. SB 1244. Yeah. And by the way, that piece of legislation, the chief co-patron on the House side is Delegate Patrick Hope, who is chairman of the Judiciary Committee. So this bill has, some real legs to it. The answer to your question is, the lawyers, you guys know what the Supreme Court's like these days. There was a, 5-4 decision back in 1997 that greenlighted these laws. Kennedy was the swing vote, and he laid out in his concurring opinion the path to demonstrating that these laws are in fact unconstitutional because they are not the lie that was told to the U.S. Supreme Court. But when recently there was a case 3 years ago that came up for review, and the Supreme Court denied cert. So I think the lawyers are largely discouraged. The advocates are not. People on the ground who are trying to demonstrate a politically relevant constituency, there are so many families who are deeply impacted by these laws. I hear horror stories on a daily basis of kids that are homeless because their dad gets picked up for a technical violation while he's on supervised release under this program. All sorts of deep harm that's being caused to the community. And those people are starting to come together. They're starting to say, hell no, this is not, the Jeffersonian values that our democracy was founded on. And this has got to go.
Hey, Galen, what can people do who are listening to the show and might run into somebody who's being held illegally for on this violent sexual predator civil commitment law? What can folks do? Is there a number to call or something?
Yeah, absolutely. Let me give you guys the number.
Give
the
us
number
that information.
Yeah, the number is 202-350.
202-350-0531. 0531.
Yeah, and the website is ajustfuture.org.
AjustFuture.
Yep. And, it's easy to remember. We believe in a just future. We're working to build a just future.
Okay. All right, so people can call that number for information on what they can do if they run into somebody who's expressing the same situation. Because this is, we've been talking about your case a couple of times on the show, Gail, and this is, I'm glad you're home, man. I'm glad to see that you're getting involved. And, you know, things happen to people for different reasons that we can't even see or understand. But maybe, man, since you've been a part of this, you're in a good position, man. You understand the ins and outs, and maybe you can help direct folk, man, to see what we can do to get this thing overturned. Because this is a national issue. This ain't just in Virginia. This is happening all over the country.
So, Roach, the people working to abolish these systems, they're on the right side of history, and this is going to happen, you know, eventually one way or the other. We're just trying to make it happen faster to get these people back to their communities.
Go ahead, Nikichi.
So we have another caller. We have another caller on the line. The number is 202-588-0893. Oh, that's the PFW number, but I think...
God, the PFW are calling you, Kichi.
Okay, we got another call on. Hello, you're on the air.
Hey, I had
you're on the air. Question or comment, please.
I had a question for you, gentlemen. First, I wanted to say I'm sorry to hear you went through that issue. But I had a question, and I missed the early part of the of his commentary. I wanted to know what he went to jail for. Does he believe that he did break the law? And in his mind, why did he do it? And what does he think? Let's say they hadn't done that, the unconstitutional. Give him extra time. I don't know if that affected him or not, but does he believe that he maybe would commit that kind of a crime again? And the next question, but follow up is how, what does he believe is the way that you talk about different therapists? How can they, what's the best way to approach the prevention before it happens? And then also to rehabilitate those who have done it to try to make sure they don't do it again. So what is his comment on that?
Let's take your first two questions. Come on, because we ain't got much time. Take your first two. All right, Galen.
Sure, I'll jump in. It was kind of hard to hear the gentleman, but I'll jump in. So I think the question was, you know, do I think that I broke the law? I absolutely broke the law when I was 19. I was 19. I'm 37 now. That was 18 years ago. I haven't been accused of a crime in 18 years. And these systems are designed to label people based on criminal behavior and just never let them go. It's permanent, unending punishment with no end in sight and no point to it. This does not make society safer. It doesn't. They tell me that they're helping me not commit crimes by taking away all of my civil liberties, and that's not true. I don't need help not committing crimes, as you know, the 4 years that I was out before clearly shows. And so the second question is, you know, what does primary prevention look like? You know, how to stop the crimes before they happen. You know, there is this foundational myth that sex is different. Americans believe this, and it's not true. The people commit sexual crimes for many of the same reasons that sorts of other crimes. You know, people had way too much to drink and act impulsively. People were young, dumb, and, you know, made a really bad life choice. And many of the people in these systems, you know, committed their offense when they were teenagers. There was one young man who was 14, and he had a consensual relationship with a girlfriend at his middle school who was a slightly younger than him. And Virginia, in all of its infinite wisdom, committed him. It's ridiculous. But the primary prevention basically targets things that we know in the rest of the criminal legal system, you know, really help people on the reentry side, for example, or help stem crime to begin with. Education, for example, invest in education and people, crime rates fall dramatically. Housing, employment, these basic core aspects of life. But then also, like specifically on the sexual side, educating young people, you know, about these systems and about consent and harm. And those are sorts of things that dramatically can reduce harm before it occurs.
Okay. We got a couple of minutes to go. Nikeecha, you want to give us some brief closing remarks on before we get away from you?
Yes, I just want to really thank Galen. I'd like to thank Dr. Bernita Thompson,
yes,
and Galen's mom, Garnett, for really bringing this issue to our attention really over the past couple of years. I know we on Crossroads have highlighted this issue, bringing it out from under the rug and from behind the corners, trying to bring it into the forefront. I know at the Justice Roundtable, you know, I've had folk on. So we're just trying to help shine a light on issues such as this. So thank you for lending your voice and helping to educate the WPFW community here. So that's all I would like to say, Ron.
And thank you. And again, I just want to echo what she just said to Dr. Thompson and to your mother. Thank the man. Without your mother, Galen, you'd probably still be in there. Your mother has been a tornado.
It's true. And it's the women that do the work that, you know, move us forward. There you go.
You said the magic word. Women do the majority of this work in criminal justice to bring about these changes. Whether they're attorneys, mothers, sisters, wives, or whatever. Women are there. And your mother, boy, I mean, she has been on the forefront fighting your case along with Dr. Thompson about her son. So I want to thank you all for bringing these topics to us that we can share with everybody.